I'm James St. James. This is Night Fever, New York nightlife legends of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, the co-founder of World of Wonder, Randy Barbato. It's good to see you.
Hey there. Fenton's going to be so bummed he's not here today.
Fenton is off gallivanting the globe, as usual, and he's going to miss it because this is going to be a fun episode, I predict. Mm-hmm. Our guest today is a drag legend. She is a boy bar beauty from way back when. She is a DJ, makeup artist, and photographer. She is a rock star fronting the legendary band Toilet Boys. She is a club promoter who co-produced the long-running 90s rock club Squeeze Box. Welcome to the show, the one and only Miss Guy!
Let me just say my preferred pronouns are it.
I was going to ask because I always just think of you as a sister in arms. You know, she's just misguided.
Yeah, no.
But do you?
No, I prefer he.
You are a he.
I get called she my whole life, really. But certainly since I've been in New York. And then, you know, a lot of people just automatically call me they, them, you know.
Sure. Okay.
Which I can relate to being a Gemini. I suppose.
Okay. Okay. Well, I take it all back then. He is a longtime drag queen. He is a DJ makeup artist.
What are your preferred pronouns, James?
I don't care what you call me. I am he, him, she, her, they, them.
Just call me.
Just please call me. Definitely. The last time we talked, Guy, you were just about to embark on a whirlwind UK tour with Debbie Harry doing her makeup. How did that go? You were there, well, gone for a month.
Yeah, almost a month. Yeah, most of June. It was really fun. A lot of fun shows and lots of traveling. And
the Glastonbury show she did, right? That was the highlight, probably.
Yeah, that was the highlight. And also, playing with Iggy Pop in London. And Billy Idol was on the bill and the Buzzcocks. So that was great. But Glastonbury was pretty amazing. And she went on, you know, right before Elton John.
Oh, wow.
Right before Blondie, Cat Stevens played, and he was incredible.
I saw that.
So I had never been to Glastonbury. It was the third time I think Blondie's played it, but it was a lot of fun.
Traveling with Debbie, do you have a lot of downtime? How do people react to Debbie when they see her? Does she go out on the nights off? Like, just tell me like a little bit about the behind the scenes.
Sometimes on a night off, she'll go pop in somewhere, but usually it's just like dinner or something. In the UK, the fans, they get pretty excited. You know, there's always fans waiting at her hotel, and I don't know how they find out where they're staying. She's pretty generous with the fans, and you know, signs. They always have things to sign,
and some people can be really snippy about that. But I'm glad to hear that she's not that.
No, I mean sometimes she'll say no to a photo if she's not feeling, you know, glamorous, I suppose, or if she's tired. But
the images that I saw of this last tour, she looks so amazing.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I liked having a hand in helping her. And some of them shows the makeup I really loved. And some of them shows, you know, we're in a hurry and there's not enough time. I'd like to take more time. And she, you know, likes it done as quick as possible. So, but overall, I mean, she's got such an easy face to make up because she has the best bone structure, you know?
Yes, it's quite a canvas.
And you guys have like known each other and worked together like for a really long time.
I first met her in the late 80s at when Stephen Sprouse opened his shop in Soho. Remember, were you guys there?
Oh, God, I went there every night. Yes, before for an outfit for the world. Yeah. Yeah.
That was like 87 or 88. And she came up to me. I was wearing this paper Kiss jacket that you could get in the fan club in the late 70s. And I hear this voice behind me say, oh, I have that jacket, or I like your jacket. And I turned around. It was her. And, you know,
face. Yes.
Her face circa 1987. I almost fainted. being such a huge fan. And I think she said that her and Chris had those jackets as well. And I still have mine. It's a teeny tiny little thing and it's made out of paper. It's pretty cute. But that was my first encounter with her in real, you know, real life. In the early 90s, I started seeing her around and at parties and clubs. And we got to become pretty friendly through Michael Schmidt, who was my roommate at the time.
Well, it's interesting because I know that as a child, well, in your preteen years and teen years, that Parallel Lines was, you know, absolutely the album that changed your life. And you were a fan from way back. What was it about her then that made you become a super fan?
One of my older brothers got really into like a lot of the punk and new wave stuff. So when I was in about fifth or sixth grade, he brought home a bunch of records one day, all in the same, you know, he went out and bought the Blondie Parallel Lines, the first Devo, the first B-52s, a Ramones record maybe, and maybe an Elvis Costello record, and the first Pretenders record, I think. So those all made a big impact on me just because I had never heard anything like that. But Blondie especially was exciting for me because I was always obsessed with like Kiss or Bowie or Cher or Elton John, anybody that was visual. And I also was obsessed with Marilyn Monroe. So to see this beautiful woman who looked like Marilyn-ish, but also looked sort of like an alien. And growing up in Southern California, I had never seen any girls that looked like that. Everybody in those late 70s days looked like Stevie Nicks or surfer girls, you know, like tan and feathered blonde hair. Nobody, I had never really seen anybody wear all black. I've tried explaining this to younger friends over the years how, you know, it was truly outrageous to see someone with bleach blonde hair and then the back be dark.
It was!
And I had never seen before, so I was like, you know, what the fuck? She was so beautiful, and she is so beautiful, and, you know, sings like an angel, but she had this toughness that was very intimidating. And so I was a little bit afraid of her, just as a child worshiping my favorite rock stars, in that way, kind of like that Bowie sort of was sort of scary, but...
What is the one where he was in the dress?
Boys Keep Swinging.
I remember my mother turned off the television when that was on. She said, "You can't." Like, I could not watch that, and I was obsessed. I was terrified and obsessed at the same time. You know,
I think that was what I was drawn to with my music. I liked things that were sort of intimidating but exciting and also great. For example, like when my brother put on the first B-52s record. And I was staring at the cover and I had never seen anything like them. And Planet Claire started and I was so like scared. And I said, take this off. It was so creepy and eerie to me. But then, you know, after a couple more listens, I ended up being obsessed with that record.
Planet Claire is a little disturbing. And, you know, to go back to what you were talking about seeing Debbie with the hair. I remember seeing Terry Nunn in Berlin with the dip-dyed hair, and it was bleach blonde with the black tips, and I'd never seen anything like it. Or like Dale Boggio. I mean, during that period, there were so many of those things that you saw that you had never seen before, and you were just... It's hard to explain to younger people how insane it was coming from the suburbs to see something like that.
Yeah, and it was exciting. And, you know, now you see... Everybody has a great look and everybody has access to looking good in a certain way. I mean, you know, it used to be a hassle just to try to find a cool pair of shoes or good makeup or good hair dye. You know, we like growing up, my best friend and I had to drive to Los Angeles to go shopping and to find cool makeup or, you know, manic panic hair dye because where I grew up, there was nothing around at all. So we would drive for 2 hours to go, shopping. And that was more like when we were 15, you know.
That's funny because when I remember when I was 16, I think I've talked about this on the show, my idols were all Truman Capote and Andy Warhol and John Waters. And I remember driving 2 hours to go get an interview magazine because there was no access to any of those. I would do that every month. I would get a Village Voice and an interview. And that was how I managed to find out who was who and all. I mean, yeah. Like, you really had to fight to find your idols back then.
Yeah, I we used to go, you know, to LA and buy details.
Well, tell me a little bit about growing up in Southern California in the late 70s, early 80s. Were you with Lauren Pine back then? Was she your best friend? She was.
Yeah. We met in fourth grade.
Stop it.
Yeah.
I don't know if the listeners know this, but Lauren Pine was Bo Peep. She was a club kid. She would hate to be called that. She was a paper superstar, mostly. And she had the most outrageous makeup and the looks. And you were friends with her since you were fourth grade.
Yeah, yeah. We moved to New York together after high school. She ran the makeup counter at Pat Fields for like second half of the 80s.
Yes.
But Lauren and I bonded in high school over Culture Club's first record.
Yeah.
So we had a class together and she brought Kissing to Be Clever in. I think we were in ninth or 10th grade science class. And she said, I think you might like this record. My sister bought it. And it's pretty good. They're a new band from England. And we were like mesmerized by the cover and the beauty of the person on the cover. And I said, is that the singer? And she's like, yeah. And I said, she's so beautiful and what a strange look. And she's like, I'm not sure. She's like,
it's a boy.
Her name's Boy George. So it was really like, what the fuck?
I remember that confusion very well. And I had a best friend that we were like, is it Boy George? I mean, is it a boy? Is it a girl? It's just, yes, that's so funny. We all had those parallel conversations. I wonder though, because my mother and father were very strict and I wasn't allowed to. I remember a lot of songs on the radio. Oh, no, we can't let, you know, turn that off. And it gave me something to rebel from. It gave me a firm foundation of what I wanted to explore, you know, the things that were forbidden from me. And I wonder, it all sort of seems to come out in the end, doesn't it? Like whether you have permissive parents or strict parents.
Well, my parents were very cool when I was a child growing up, and we were a musical family. My dad played in bands and my older brothers played in bands. And so there was always rock music playing on the turntable or on the radio. But my dad started getting a little bit conservative and religious around the time that I was about 15, which was just as I was starting to like paint my nails and shave my eyebrows off and dye my hair and all the things that somewhat conservative, but sweet man, but cool for most of my childhood. But he didn't like that or understand it or accept it. So I had to fight to sort of let him let me do what I wanted. And he did in the end. But he didn't mind when I was into like Kiss and Bowie and Blondie and the Ramones and all of that. But once I got into like Boy George and Marilyn, he was not happy.
We were a different type of gay that I don't think that they didn't have a frame of reference for it. And I think we confounded them in many ways.
But also when you think about like just any kind of fluidity or that kind of expression was just so radical back then. The world's so different now. It's radical that you were exploring with that.
You can't discount the impact that MTV had on our generation. That it is what, you know, Instagram and Twitter. I mean, like, it was how we connected to the world in a way that nobody had ever connected before.
But still, there was like a barrier. Like, media is so different now that even though we saw those images, it's like, I don't know, I just remember growing up and, you know, living in suburbia, it's like all of that was over there somewhere. Mm. Like you felt like you were living in a world of conformity, that everything, all of that expression was something you'd see in a magazine or on TV and wasn't real unless you got to New York or you were like a radical queen like you.
Yeah, I mean, in the late 70s, we never had MTV, my family. But I used to go to my friend's house. I'd go over there and we'd watch MTV. But in the late 70s, I've also told this to younger friends. I said, for me, music magazines were like my lifesaver my whole life. And I would save my allowance to buy every new rock magazine every time a new one came out. And then sometimes you could catch your favorite musical artist on TV performing on like Don Kirshner's rock concert or the Midnight Special. And thankfully I was able to go to concerts, but I said, you know, the thing that was so, it was so magical to see your favorite rock star in concert or even on TV, because you never really got to see them in movement. You only saw, you would stare at magazines, pictures in magazines, and you would stare at the record covers while you listened to the record, but you never got to see them move. So to see them actually moving on TV was like really mind blowing. And then forget it, seeing them in concert where it wasn't a screen. You were actually, you know, there and you could reach out and touch them. It was really exciting. And I think a lot of that magic is gone. I still get excited and I can still find shows to be magical, but it's not the same. And I don't even think it's an age thing, because I just think it was the fact that you couldn't, now we see all our favorite artists in movement 24/7, every, you know what I mean? So it's not as exciting as it was in those days, for me anyway.
I remember seeing Adam and the Ants when they were on the Late Late Show, and I snuck up to watch TV to see it. And I went to school the next day and I was like, there are these ant people and they do ant music. And it was like, it was like so electrifying to me.
Those were exciting times for music. I mean, Bow Wow Wow was my favorite band until Culture Club. Then that was my absolute favorite for several years. But there was so much great music coming out of England in the early 80s.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
At 17 years old, you are at a party in Los Angeles and you run into a superstar who tells you something. What was that?
Well, that was Malcolm McLaren, and Lauren and I, it was our senior year of high school, and we were planning on moving to Los Angeles after we graduated. And we got invited to this party somehow, which I still don't know how, but I should ask her. Maybe she might remember. But you know, we used to go to get dressed up and go shopping on Melrose and meet people. And we would go see shows, sometimes go to parties. But we get invited to this Malcolm McLaren party at the Le Mondrian. And we got all dressed up and we went and we met him. And it was very brief. It was a very small party. It was in his room, if I remember correctly. He had like a suite. We met him and took photos with him. I had my little Instamatic camera. He said, oh, you know, he liked the way we looked. And he said, have you guys ever been to New York? And we said, no, we're moving to, we're still in high school and we're going to move to LA when we graduate. And he said, oh, you guys should go to New York. They would love you there. So the next day at school, we were like, I guess we're going to New York. We started saving our money and moved to New York after we graduated high school.
It was 85, right? When you got to New York?
Yeah.
You went out that first night that you were in town. Do you remember where you went and what you wore?
I don't remember what I wore, but I do know that me and Lauren's friend, Erica, we used to sew stuff together. The three of us, really. But Erica really knew how to sew. So I would design these little weird things and she would sew them up for me if I couldn't hand sew something. And so I probably had a pair of pants like that she made me. And, Lauren was done in the Bo Peep drag. And we got to New York on a Thursday and we went to Boy Bar and got in. We were with Perfidia, who was a friend of ours from San Diego. And he had moved to New York like about a month or two before us. And he met a lot of people right away. And then we went to Boy Bar and saw Connie, Glamamore, and Shannon do a show. And I was just blown away because we used to go to this club in LA called Peanuts and see the drag shows there.
Sure, yeah. Old school drag, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there were three that I remember that were good. There was this queen named Viva who did Madonna. And then there was this queen whose name I don't know. I don't know if we ever met. I have photos of her, who did an amazing Grace Jones. And then there was this other queen who was gorgeous called Madam Adam. And she did like Joan Jett lip syncs. They all did lip syncs. And so that was fun. But, you know, in New York, when we, that first night we saw Connie, Glamamore, and Shannon, I had never seen anything like that because Glamamore was so demented and Connie was so gorgeous. And I think she did a lip sync to Walking on Thin Ice by Yoko Ono and was cartwheeling on stage in a bikini and like, you know, a white mule. And then Shannon was still blonde at the time, and I just thought she was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. I couldn't believe that she was a boy in drag. And then, so after the show, then we went into the Palladium and went up to the Mike Todd room. And I don't remember who was there, but I feel like Warhol was there and Boy George was definitely there, because he and I, Lauren and I had sort of befriended him the last couple of years we were in California. Whenever Culture Club would play, we'd go see him and he would invite us to TV tapings, and we got friendly with him. So when we saw him in New York, he was a bit of a mess, but he was still as sweet as he always was to us. So we would see him out and he would say, oh, I'm going to go to Paradise Garage tonight, you know, if you guys want to meet me there. And so that was exciting. And, you know, we would see Diane Brill and you, James. You were one of the first people I remember meeting, and I feel like it was a boy bar, and you had long blonde hair and maybe sequin pants on and pumps and a blazer. Does that sound right?
That was the look back then. I definitely remember meeting you because I was like, that bitch, she's a better version of me. she's doing me, but she does it better.
At the time, I was sort of trying to emulate Marilyn.
Totally. I was doing Marilyn too. Marilyn was so nasty to me, though. Marilyn was always so mean, but I loved him. I would follow him around everywhere.
Same. Yeah, we met Marilyn in L.A. He was out there. It was probably right after we graduated high school, or maybe we were still in high school. It was 85, and Culture Club was touring, and George invited us to his hotel, and we were out in front of his hotel, me, Lauren, and George talking. And Marilyn zipped up in a sports car with some cute boy. And George said, these are my friends that I was telling you about. And Marilyn was not very nice to us. And then when we got to New York, I was also ripping off her look, and I'm sure she didn't like that one.
Sure. Yeah, I think she was threatened.
Or trying to rip it off, because no, I didn't look half as good as Marilyn. I mean, Marilyn was stunning.
So beautiful. So beautiful.
Yeah. And so when we got to New York, we would see Marilyn out, and Marilyn was always not very unfriendly to us, and especially me. But so when I met you, I was like, oh, you know, this nightlife celebrity is so sweet, and he does the look that I love, because, you know, I didn't really put it together at the time that you were doing Marilyn, but, you know, it makes sense. And, you know, not a lot of people even knew who Marilyn was in America in those days, you know. So
when I was in high school and the Who's That Girl video came out, Eurythmics, and at the very end of it, Who's That Girl? And it turns around and it was Marilyn, and I fell out of my chair.
In a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
Start your engines and join me in the new mobile game, RuPaul's Drag Race Superstar. May the best superstar win. Available now.
And from that moment on, I was obsessed. And then seeing he was in the Do They Know It's Christmas, I remember that was the next time I saw him. We could do a whole show about Marilyn.
We could, yeah. But those were fun times in New York, and it was truly magical. I was enjoying the times at the time, but I was also thinking, well, I missed the best days in New York because I was so obsessed with the 70s, and I felt like, oh, if I'd been born 5 or 10 years earlier, I could have made it to New York in the 70s. But
doesn't everybody think that at some point? Doesn't everybody go to think that, oh, I missed the Mud Club. Oh, I missed... You know, and then the people like, they, yeah. Oh, I missed Area. I missed Rave.
I was happy to experience the tail end of Area and Palladium and Danceteria and all those places. Now I would, you know, kill for just one of those to be able to go to one of those. But then, you know, in those days too, it was like multiple things like that to do a night, every single night. It was kind of insane. So it really was, I mean, I didn't miss anything. I just missed the beginning of punk in New York. But I mean, the 80s in New York was incredibly insane. And I don't know how we were able to get invited to these parties, but I'm so glad that we did.
It's interesting because I think you became like a star, a downtown star, really quickly. And I know that like that whole idea of getting into clubs for free and getting drink tickets and having your picture taken, that sort of felt validating at the time, that like you were accepted into this crowd of weirdos. But there was also a feeling that you and I have talked about where these stars, the Diane Brills and John Sexton and Terry Toy, that they were on par with Madonna, Boy George. In my mind, at least, they were the same. You know, I mean, the stars were the stars were the stars.
I felt that way about Divine.
Yeah.
To me, it was all the same. And I was just as excited to see John Sexton or Bernard, you know, Zet, as I was to see
Tom Cruise or, you know, I mean, like, I wonder if there was the thing about that is that, you know, like Boy George came from the London scene and Madonna came from the New York scene. And there was a feeling that everybody was in queue. Everybody was in line and anybody could be next at any time. And, you know, Dean Johnson could be the first white rapper, or when D-Light happened, like there was that feeling like, who's next? Who's next?
Yeah. And a lot of people from the downtown New York scene did, you know, have success. And there was a time where everybody just was happy to get into clubs for free and drink for free, like you said. Every Thursday, I'd go to Boy Bar and watch the Queens perform. And I didn't necessarily want to do drag shows, but I wanted to get on stage somehow. And I knew I wanted to start a band, but I was very shy. And I was not certain how to go about meeting musicians that were going to be into what I wanted to do. So one night, Matthew Caston came up to me at Boy Bar after the show. And he said, I like the way you look. You know, you're always dressed up. And, you know, would you ever want to do a show here? And I was like, oh, yeah, I would love to. So I did a show there. And I was so nervous. I was looking for any kind of excuse to get out of doing it. And I was doing a lip sync. And I was still just so incredibly nervous. And I remember telling Lauren, well, should I say I'm sick? But I feel like if I say I'm sick, that he'll just say, you know, take whatever drugstore medicine and come do the show. So I was like, I have to come up with something that will definitely make me not be able to go on stage and drag. And I was thinking, saying that I had a really bad sty in my eye or something. And in the end, she said, you just go do it. You've been wanting to do this. And so go do it. And I did. And
do you remember what the number was?
Yeah. My hair was bleached blonde at the time and platinum. And he did a Betty Grable do on me. And I did sort of 50s makeup. I wore a tangerine beaded gown. And I did a lip sync to Hooray for Hollywood by Doris Day, I think. And I mean, yeah, it was Doris Day's version. And I didn't feel a connection to the song. And he was trying to push me as like a Hollywood glamour type.
That wasn't in your wheelhouse.
He would pick songs for me and I would do them. And he would dress, you know, put wigs on me or fix my hair. But finally he said, you know, You really aren't coming out of your shell. Why don't you pick a song that you want to do? And I said, okay. And I did. I picked Cherry Bomb by The Runaways and did a lip sync to that. And the crowd sort of, you know, ate it up, or at least I thought they did. But I definitely got a better response doing a lip sync to Cherry Bomb than I did doing Hooray for Hollywood by Doris Day.
I was visualizing you as you were telling this story. I think just that idea of doing these shows, but you being so shy, it's a lot of work emotionally, yeah. Right?
Yeah, it was good school for me. I learned a lot doing those shows and also had so much fun. But I mean, in the back of my mind, I was always thinking, you know, I want to do something live and I want to do rock. And, you know, a few queens would come to Boy Bar and do live shows, but not a lot. It was mostly lip sync, you know. And then I met, you know, some people who were involved in the pyramid scene and started popping over there from Boy Bar. And I really enjoyed those shows because they weren't as traditional as the Boy Bar.
They were a little dangerous and they were a little more.
Yeah, and I saw Taboo and she was doing a lip sync to Alice Cooper and had drippy eye makeup, but like a 60s Cher wig on. So I was like, that's what I want to do, you know. So I didn't get many bookings at Pyramid, but I became friends with everybody there and performed there a handful of times. But I loved going to see the shows there. The Sundays were the best.
Well, speaking of those kinds of looks, I don't know if you know this, but you inspired a whole club kid movement and a party. Do you remember it was the house of Jackie 60 Ball at Nell's? category was dead celebrities, and you came out as
pregnant Sharon Tate, right?
Yes.
Wasn't I?
You were the...
Oh, yeah, of course. She was killed when she was pregnant.
Yes.
Yeah.
You were the ghost of Sharon Tate. You had white makeup on, and you were covered with blood, and you ran down the runway, and the baby fell out as you were running down the runway, and everyone gasped because it was in such awful taste.
Oh, yeah, I know. I was thinking of some funny shit I used to do during those days at the balls. But that world was so intimidating to me, but so fascinating. And I walked in a couple of the balls for the House of Feel, but I would always do something silly. And those queens took all of that so seriously. But I entered like a sports realness. And so I did a cheerleader look, and did some kind of stupid cheer. I don't know how to cheer, but and then I lifted up my skirt at the end of the runway and I had like bloody panties. And then another time I walked for face in the House of Field Ball at the Roxy. And I did like this black cat suit with a hood and, you know, painted my face and walked. And then I got to the end of the runway and took the hood off and I had these big pigtails and I did some stupid smile like and had like a blacked out tooth. And it was just so dumb. But they didn't seem very fond of me making.
But wait, but I do have to say, though, that after the Sharon Tate thing, I came up to you and asked you about the blood. And you sort of explained to me, you walked me through the corn syrup and all that. And I started doing the bloody wedding gowns and everything. And after that, Michael started doing his bruises and bloods. And then he started doing emergency room in which everyone was covered in blood. And so I think that we have you to thank for all those clubs being covered in corn syrup for about a year.
I love that. It would get very slippery too if you were
And it was sticky and it never dried. Oh, it was just terrible.
I think at that Jackie 61, that was when it was at the very beginning when it was at Nell's.
Yeah.
And I did, I slipped in it and I fell on the stage. I think there's photos somewhere. I totally forgot about that. So thank you for reminding me about that.
We've sort of touched on, like, how did we do it? How did we go out every single night? Different outfits, you know, three clubs in after hours, robots, you know, Sound Factory. How did you afford it? When did you sleep? How did we do any of that? How did we afford cabs?
Well, I don't know, but cabs were so cheap in those days.
That's
I just recently started flipping through some of my old journals from those days. And there was a journal entry from March of 89, I think. It was at like 5:45 in the morning. And I wrote, me and Bunny went to Pyramid, The Building, and the Roxy tonight. Had a great time, something like that. All three of those places, you know, in high heels, I'm sure, and dressed up. And, you know, we were probably on ecstasy, I would imagine, if I was writing in my journal at 5:45 in the morning. But it made me really feel sort of nostalgic for those days because I couldn't even probably find three things to do in a month now in New York.
Well, all three of those things, Roxy, Building, and Pyramid, would be completely different crowds. And yet all three of them would be absolutely fabulous on any given night. Yeah. You know, like there was so much to do in so many different crowds and scenes to see, and every single place you went would be just as fabulous as the place before.
Yeah. And I mean, we used to walk around a lot in those days too. I never hesitated to stomp down to Boy Bar from the Chelsea Hotel where I was living for a while in high heels and walk home at the end of the night, you know. And I mean, we all drank for free. Everybody drank for free. I don't know how we did, but I think in those days, you know, and maybe that's what Malcolm McLaren was sort of saying when he told us that they would love us and that we should go to New York. Getting dressed up, putting some effort into your appearance really went a long way in those days. So you would not know the doorman, but you would go up and they would let you in most of the time. And you would get to know that person if you frequented that club and you made friendships. And, you know, it was amazing. I mean, all I cared about my first year in New York probably was just being able to go out every night and have fun. And that's what we did, you know. But then you start getting more ambitious. Like, oh, well, now I want to perform. And now I want to start a band. But, you know, I don't know what people that come to New York or Los Angeles now, what their main ambition is regarding nightlife, you know.
To be an Instagram star or to do TikTok videos. Mm-hmm. Or...
Yeah.
But you did eventually have a day job to help subsidize all of this by working at Pat's. She was our first interview of the season, and you are our last. So that's a nice bookend.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I saw the Pat one. I mean, I love Pat. She was so great to me. I met her through Lauren because Lauren got a job there like our first or second day in New York. And Pat seemed very fond of Lauren and sort of took her under her wing. She can be very tough, but she was always really nice to me for some reason. And she gave me some really good words of encouragement early on when I really needed it. She was such a big deal. And for someone like that to say such nice things to me really helped me out a lot and helped with my confidence. But it was such a fun job. It didn't feel like work. We would just go there and fight over what music we wanted to hear. But it was fun and you could do anything in those days. I mean, everybody smoked in the store and I'm sure people were coming down off drugs, if not taking drugs. And
I remember because I lived with Cody. I remember.
I was thinking Cody when I said that. Yeah. He, you know, and Pat paid everybody in cash.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. So you could go out that night.
Yeah, I think we got paid at the end of the day. If you worked there part time, you would get your shift pay at the end of the day. But if you worked there full time, maybe you got pay at the end of the week. I don't remember how it worked. Or maybe she paid you a little bit of cash at the end of every day, but then you got a check once a week. But I think it was mostly cash. You got a great discount.
Everyone who worked there was turned out every night.
You got at least 50% off, if not more. And then also she was fine with letting you take something off the rack and wear it.
I was going to say you could borrow things too, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was certainly the craziest job I think I've ever had. And we had some good times together, Pat and I.
I guess we need to sort of zip forward up to Squeezebox. And how did that get started? Tell us about the concept of the club. And more importantly, who performed and what were some of the scandals?
Well, let's see. In the late 80s and early 90s, I was going out in two different worlds. I would go to the Cat Club on Wednesday nights, which was the rock night, and it was straight. But I was friends with some of the guys. The DJ Joe was I befriended, and I knew a lot of the girls that hung out in that scene, Raphael and Betty from the Cycle Sluts, and you know, so I made a lot of friends there. And then I would also go out to the gay clubs, the Roxy on Saturday nights and Boy Bar on Thursdays and whatever. So I had a couple of friends who we were always sort of like, wouldn't it be nice to go to a gay club where you could hear rock and punk. And me and Michael Schmidt and Lauren and Martine were all roommates at that time. And so we started Squeezebox. I had started DJing about a year before by accident. And I got a lot of, you know, attention as a DJ at the time because I guess I was doing something that not a lot of people were doing or whatever. And so I DJed at this little bar in the East Village. And Formica was there a lot hanging out and sometimes would perform. And I had never met her, but I had heard about her. She was new to New York and she would do lip syncs of like Heart and Pat Benatar. And, oh, cool. A rock queen, you know, she would be great. So I don't know if I contacted her or Michael Schmidt contacted her, but then we did it. And Don Hills, he was the owner of Cat Club. And I knew him a little bit from going there on Wednesday night.
I didn't realize that Don Hill owned Don Hills and Cat Club. I never put that together.
Yeah, so he was the doorman at the Cat Club was kind of a dick because I was always dressed up in those days and I was also under 21. So even though you didn't get carded anywhere, he would use that as an excuse to try to keep me out because he just didn't like me. He was slightly homophobic. We ended up becoming friends at some point. But anyway, Don would often be at the door. So if he saw me and if he saw that guy, Mark, giving me a hassle, Don would always say, come on in and get me a drink at the bar. So he was always very sweet to me. And so when he got involved with the space that became Don Hills, it was a restaurant. I think it was called Canal Bar. Is that
yeah,
right?
Sure.
Do you remember that? You know, it was a restaurant that was certainly out of my price range in those days. So when that closed, then Don got it. And he had it for about 6 months before we started Squeezebox and nothing was really happening there. So he gave us full freedom to do whatever we wanted and full support. And so we started Squeezebox in April of 94. And it was, you know, it got off to a slow start. It wasn't making any money. But there was, every night was magical. There was like a, you know, that feeling in the air where you knew it was something special. And then I think by that summer, it was pretty much on fire and celebrities started coming. I think, you know, of course, Debbie Harry was one of the first. And John Waters.
I was going to say, I always remember seeing John Waters, Drew Barrymore, Juliette Lewis. They were some of the, and Joan Jett was I think there.
Jane County would come and hang out and perform, and Dee Dee Ramone, Joey Ramone, Cherry Vanilla, Lee Childers, B.B. Buell, a lot of the people that were involved in the 70s scenes.
B.B. Buell, we need to get B.B. on the show.
All these people started coming, and then crazy celebrities started coming, like Mick Jagger. Well, he only came once, but, you know, Verushka came.
Oh, wow.
JFK Jr. came one night, and Goldie Hawn came in Tura Satana. It was like
Goldie Hawn and Tura Satana in the same room. That is the most fabulous thing I've ever heard.
I had to go up to Goldie Hawn. I wouldn't go up to anybody unless they came up to me, and sometimes they would come up to me because I was the DJ. And I said, I just have to say, you know, me and my mom have always been big fans, and I'm the DJ, and I had to come over and meet you because my mom would kill me if she knew that you were at my party and I didn't say hello and meet you. So she was very sweet. And Naomi Campbell all would come with Marc Jacobs and Courtney Love and Marilyn Manson and the guys from Green Day. And it was really great. And Dawn was amazing and, you know, the nicest person in the world to work for. And
it was very sad when he died, when he passed away a few years ago. Yeah, you don't realize just how much these people mean to you until they're gone. And then you think, that was a part of my life. That was, you know, they were really an influence.
He was a doll. I mean, he was really the nicest.
Did you start Toilet Boys there? And how did they start?
I put a band together to perform there. And it was the night that Debbie Harry was going to be playing. And so Michael asked me if I wanted to gather a band and do it. So I asked a few friends. We kind of put a band together for this one-off opening for Debbie. And she didn't see us that night, thank God, because we were terrible. But once the final lineup came together, we got a little bit of a buzz going, I guess, because people knew me as the DJ and I dressed up. And I guess we were fun and silly, but we hadn't quite come together yet. But then by the time we got our solid lineup down and got our act together with Sean, my guitar player, and he really brought me out of my shell as a performer. We started getting a lot of good gigs and people started coming to see us play, like Debbie and Joey Ramone and Dee Dee Ramone. And Dee Dee Ramone wrote about us in his book. And, you know, all this weird stuff started happening. Bob Gruen brought Ace Frehley from Kiss to see us play. And so we started getting a lot of press. And then Blondie reunited and asked us to play some shows opening for them. And, you know, all these things that were happening that I just never would have imagined.
I read that when I was going through some interviews with you, and there were some people said, you know, that you either opened for or played with Guns N' Roses, Red Hot Chili Peppers, the Ramones, Motorhead, Joan Jett, the Damned, the Donnas. I mean, did you open for all these people? That's crazy.
Yeah, we toured with some of them and did one-offs with some of them. And yeah, it's kind of crazy when you see it on paper. And we also opened for a lot of the New York bands that I loved at the time, like Luna Chicks and Karen Black.
Oh, Kembra, we've got to get Kembra on the show.
Yeah, and I loved those bands. And so we got a lot of these great opening slots. And it was very fun. I mean, I don't know how, I guess we just sort of happened to get these gigs because we had a buzz going, you know, new people too. But, you know, I didn't know Debbie that well when she asked us to play. She just seemed to really like my band. And she came to see us play one night at Don Hills. And then she came to see us at CB's opening for somebody, I don't remember who. And I thought, oh, she just came to see whoever we were opening for at CB's. We were done playing and it was packed. And she said to me, I'm going to sneak out. I just came to see you guys. And I was like, oh my gosh, she really likes it. So that was exciting, you know, but, and we played with like Joey Ramone at his birthday party, his annual birthday party he used to do. And, you know, all this amazing stuff that was kind of incredible.
And how did it end? Why did it end? What happened?
as much as I loved opening for these bands that I grew up loving, I wanted to be playing these type of shows, headlining. So, you know, we could sell out clubs around the country and around the, we toured around the world and we did all right, but we were always just playing like rock clubs. And so I wanted to graduate onto the next level, of course. And so we got signed, the label fucked us over. We got out of that deal and we took our advance. We made our own record and put it out ourselves. We made a video for one of our songs, which MTV picked up and ended up being like a top 20 rock countdown video. So that was exciting. And then we got the tour opening for the Chili Peppers in Europe, and we played, you know, arenas every night opening for them. And in Europe, it's not like here where if you see an opening act at the Garden, chances are it's not even going to be half full. But in Europe, they line up, and as soon as doors open, the arena fills up. So we were playing two nights in every city around Europe opening for the Chili Peppers to 20,000 people. And we went over pretty well most of the show. So it was looking like things were going to happen for us. You know, we got we had the video, and we got a little bit of radio play with that song. And we made a second video, and MTV never played it. And so I think they played it once at like 1 a.m. I think because we weren't on a label, I think that somebody there liked us and put one of our songs on it that made it into the top 20 rock countdown. But then I think after that, it was sort of like, you know, they were expecting some money from a label or something. We didn't have that. So they didn't, or whatever. I don't know. Maybe they just didn't like the video or the song, but we weren't getting past that. And so when we were in Europe, we had a US tour booked for when we got back that spring. And while we were away, the Great White Fire happened. And when those people got killed, and we had played that venue right before we went to tour Europe, it looked like a building that could go up very easily. And we had pyro in our shows in those days. So nothing happened, thankfully. But when that happened, we got back to the States and we were being questioned by the FBI and like all this shit about our pyro. And so we basically were like, well, we can't do the tour because we can't do our show. And we broke up. So that was it. That's how it ended. And then we started doing one-offs here and there a few years later, you know, and we still will do a one-off here and there. But yeah, so.
Well, I have about like four pages of questions that we can still going on, but I feel like that's sort of a place to end where that sort of takes us through another chapter of your life. Randy, did you have any thoughts or...
No, I could go on forever, but I can't. So,
I know. I mean, we all have so much history together, and in New York, we could go on and on and on. We'll have to do a part two.
Yeah, because I feel like you're just getting started.
Yes.
So you were in LA at some point recently, yeah?
I go to LA pretty frequently. I was there DJing for Brian Raven's Georgios.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Actually, Brian gave the Toilet Boys our very first show in LA, and that was a lot of fun. So it was great to DJ his party. But yeah, I'm in LA quite a bit, and I would love to see you guys sometime when I'm out.
I know. Next time, let us know, because it'd be nice to meet up and you know.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I love you so much. It's so good to always catch up with you. We will see you soon.